This is Social Science Bites with me, David Edmonds. Social Science Bites is a series of interviews with leading social scientists and is made in association with SAGE. He's a most unusual academic. Anthropologist Scott Atran does much of his fieldwork on the front line of battlefields. His interest is in what motivates people in conflict and, in particular, in what he calls their sacred values. Scott Atran, welcome to Social Science Bites.
Glad to be with you.
The topic we're talking about today is sacred values. What are sacred values?
Sacred values are those ideas wedded to emotions for which people are willing to make the costliest of sacrifices. I always ask myself, how comes it that humans make their greatest exertions, including great works and killing and dying, not for their own gain, family or lives, but for the sake of an idea, a transcendent conception of who I am and who we are. This is the privilege of absurdity to which no creature but man is subject, of which Hobbes wrote in Leviathan.
So do we all have sacred values?
No. Darwin called them values highly esteemed and even sacred that give immense advantage to any group, but it's sufficient for a society, or as he says, a tribe, to win out over other tribes in the spiraling competition for survival and dominance if there are at least a few who can inspire others to unconditional cooperation and willingness to make these costly sacrifices.
The term sacred sounds like it has religious connotations. It sounds like it's connected to theology in some way.
No, sacred values can be religious or secular. As when land or law becomes holy or hallowed, for example, the constitutional law in the United States is a sacred value. Human rights has become a sacred value for our society, constructed over the course of over 250 years. We can call the secularized sacred just as important as the religious sacred. The importance is that it commands a duty and sacrifice, and it's transcendent. By that I mean it's not something that you can verify or falsify empirically or logically for its internal coherence.
And it doesn't need just to be ideas. It could be an object that could be sacred. It could be the Bible or something like that. It could be a way of life. It could be a diet, not eating pork. It could be all manner of things.
Well, those are sort of signposts for what is sacred and taboo. We don't have a theory of sacred values in a proper scientific theory, but we have been able to test for the reliability of certain features of these values. And these include immunity from material trade-offs. Most people wouldn't sell their children or sell out their country of religion for all the money in China. Sacred values are generally insensitive to temporal and spatial discounting, unlike material goods, upon which economic theory is based or even political theory is based, so that distant events and places can be more valued than the here and now. Think of the Exodus from Egypt, the flight of Muhammad from Mecca to Medina, or the Second Coming. They're blind to exit strategies. So no matter how reasonable or rewarding an offer is to abandon or compromise your sacred value, you won't give it up. In fact, material offers will usually cause people to get angrier, more violent, and opposed to any kind of negotiation. They're insensitive to quantity. It doesn't matter, for example, if I do something, say I'm a suicide bomber, just to give you an example. I kill one person or 1,000 or no one but myself, God will love me just the same. Or if I'm a martyr for civil rights, whether I succeed or not, whether I'm really punished or not, whether I die or not, is insignificant. It's the intention that's important, the commitment to the values. They generate actions independent of prospects of success because they're the right thing to do.
Let me pick up on just one of those many aspects of sacred values, which is that they can't be negotiated away. They can't be exchanged for material possessions. And you said, indeed, if you try to do that, it has the reverse effect. So it will actually entrench an initial position. So give me an example of that.
Well, good examples are pro-life or gun rights in America, Russia's feelings about the Crimea, and the right to return among the Palestinians and the right to greater Israel among settlers. So let me give you an example. We did for the Palestinians. We worked both with the leaders and with the general populations, the same with the Israelis. We did a survey in which we asked refugees in Lebanon and Jordan in Palestine, what's the probability you would go back to Israel if you had the right to return? 6% of the refugees said they would consider it. So 94 wouldn't even consider it. Would you be willing to give up the right of return as a sacred value? Over 80% said no. Then we used what was then the current negotiations in Geneva, offering to each Palestinian family the equivalent of something like £10,000, or to the Palestinian Authority, if they would make a permanent peace along the 1967 borders, but give up the right of return. Not only did they refuse, but it went to sealing. And when we tested for support for suicide bombing, and we did skin responses for emotion and moral outrage, it went through the roof.
So 94% weren't even considering going back. But when you offer them money to prevent that being even a possibility, then suddenly their views about returning become much stronger.
Yes. And most interesting, when you recognize their sacred value in some place without giving them any material compromise or response, then their opposition to peace goes way down. So even among the Hamas and PIJ leaders, Palestinian Islamic Jihad, we found willingness to talk to the Israeli leadership if the Israeli leaders, in the name of the Israeli people, would apologize for the dislocation and dispossession of the Palestinian people in 1948 without no promise whatsoever of giving any compensation or allowing them to return. They would just recognize this. Apologies usually don't figure into standard negotiations and cost-benefit analysis, but they're extraordinarily important because they show your respect for the values that drive others.
So narratives can be sacred values in a sense, in that for the Palestinians, a sacred value is the Israelis recognized the wrong that was done to them in 1948, and presumably for the Israelis, the recognition of the unique significance of the Holocaust might be a sacred value.
Well, that's what we did at Oxford in this new center that we founded called the Center for the Resolution of Intractable Conflict, and we debated this, and all parties recognized the importance of sacred values for them. And the Israelis, even with a message from the Israeli Prime Minister, and the Americans said that, look, this is a sacred value in this region, for the Israelis especially, and we are their allies, and so recognition of the Holocaust would be very important. We got in touch with President Rouhani, who agreed to give a statement on the Holocaust, not to the General Assembly, but to Christian Amanpour of CNN, and that was possibly a factor in the opening of negotiations.
And it's cost-free. Acknowledging an historical injustice costs you nothing.
No, not quite. Remember, Rouhani was met with violent protests when he returned to Tehran. Sadat made a gesture to the Israelis. In fact, Sadat specifically said, this is all about sacred values on both sides. He made that gesture. He was assassinated as a result. You know, when we asked the Hamas, for example, we went to Damascus and we talked to the leader of the Hamas, Khalid Mashal, and we talked also to Abu Marzouk, the vice chairman and former leader. Let me step back. First, we went to Mr. Netanyahu, and we said, look, we're going to Damascus. Is there anything you want to know? And he said, there's only one question that interests me. Would the leaders of the Hamas recognize the right of the Jewish people to be here in the Middle East? Everything else is negotiable. Could be an open question whether he was sincere or not, but that was what he posed to us. When we went to Damascus, we asked him, Mr. Mashal, that, and he said, our people have been in prison for almost 70 years, and our jailer wants us to recognize his right to be here. Let us out of prison, and we'll talk. They were not willing. And then we asked Mr. Mashal, so what would be important for you? And he said, recognition of the harm they did to us. I mean, lots in politics is about symbols and sacred values.
Some sacred values are not incompatible, but there are sacred values that seem to clash against each other. I'm thinking, for example, of Jerusalem, where both sides claim Jerusalem as their center. What can be done about that when you have incompatible sacred values?
Well, you can treat them like in business-like negotiations or standard political negotiations. But sacred values, based on transcendental ideas that can't be logically verified or falsified, they can be reframed and reprioritized. So Jerusalem need not be the physical Jerusalem with its present boundaries. One could define Jerusalem partly in terms of its physical territory, but also as a portal to heaven. And do both sides have access to this portal to heaven?
But do all those with sacred values have that elasticity to reprioritize what's important to them?
Yes, they don't think they're reprioritizing. It's just like religious propositions. Supposing someone said to you, and we actually do studies of this, something like, thou shalt not bow down before false idols. So we give someone a set of commandments on the board, of which one is, thou shalt not bow down before false idols. And then we invite someone from outside to come in, and they have to paraphrase it. And we go through 10 iterations of this. The 10th person we bring in, we put all sorts of propositions on the board, and we see if they can recognize the original commandment. The only ones who can do that is autists, because they literally repeat. They would say something, you can't bend your knees before a statue. Or let 1,000 flowers bloom, they would say, you can't have budding flowers, 1,000 of them. But normal people would simply say, well, I have to spend more time with my family, money isn't everything, or whatever. So by the time it's reinterpreted, no one recognizes the original commandment unless it's out there to begin with as a signpost. So with religious propositions like this, everybody has a different interpretation to begin with. There can be moments when they become fixed. For example, that's why we have preachers and rabbis and imams to reinterpret every week the same propositions in terms of the current events. And so at that moment in time, everyone might be agreed, oh yes, this means this. This means our territory can't be violated, or this means no, we can't have abortions, or something like that. But on the long run, you can always reinterpret them.
When one looks around the world and thinks of sacred values, the group one thinks of is ISIS. Yes. Is it sacred values alone that makes ISIS the powerful, threatening force that they are?
Well, that's an interesting question. When President Obama in 2014 endorsed the judgment of his National Security Director, James Clapper, that we underestimated ISIS's willingness to fight and overestimated that of the Iraqi army, because willing to fight is simply an imponderable, our hypothesis was that's because we were neglecting the spiritual dimension of human conflict. Then we went to the front lines in Iraq, most recently the offensive in Mosul. We went to the first battle in that offensive, and we went to the front lines. And we find not just for ISIS, we find this for people who support gun rights or the right to return in Palestine or whatever. What we find is that unconditional cooperation and intractable conflict are much better understood within a devoted actor rather than rational actor framework. A devoted actor has two aspects to him or her. First, commitment to sacred values, whether secular or religious. And second, a fusion of their personal identity, who I am, with a unique collective identity that gives a sense of invulnerability and willingness to sacrifice for every other individual in that particular group. I mean, we all have multiple identities, but if you're completely fused with a unique collective identity, you ratchet one another up. And when that group itself is defined in terms of its values, then you have the most effective fighting force possible.
So a fused identity is a person who ceases to see themselves as a football supporter, a Londoner, a journalist, but sees themselves only in terms of one aspect of their life.
That's right.
And combined with sacred values, that's what makes a group dangerous.
Yes, but also that's what makes a group able to do great things beyond themselves. For example, the initiators of the civil rights movement or the American Revolution, for example. The Americans were in 1776 the richest people on earth, much more than the English themselves. But they actually thought that taxation without representation and the inability to make their own decisions for themselves and determine their own fate was a sacred value. They wrote that in the Declaration of Independence. In fact, Jefferson's original word was not we hold these truths to be self-evident. He said we hold these truths to be sacred. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, which were fictions. I mean, we're not all equal. And the Americans lost. I mean, the British sent 30,000 troops to New York Harbor. There were not even 30,000 people in New York and 200 warships. They lost every battle. It was a volunteer army, and just as they were about to collapse, Washington gets up on his horse and basically said, there are values sacred for which we have to sacrifice, and he convinced the army.
I can see how it works. Is there a way of measuring, in a kind of empirical sense, people's sacred values and their identity fusion?
Yes, of course. I mean, that's what we do as scientists. So for sacred values, we can measure whether you're blind to exit strategies, whether you're immune to social pressure. Sacred values are not norms that can be changed because even the people around you change their minds. So they are entrenched. And when people change their minds around you and tell you to abandon them, you become morally outraged. And we do neuroimaging, both of fighters and non-fighters. Immunity to trade-offs. We can tell to what extent people become outraged or unwilling to trade off something they hold as sacred. And we can show that they undertake actions independent of any risks or rewards or costs or consequences. So we can measure it in various ways. Most recently, we've measured it among supporters of the Al-Qaeda affiliate Lashkar-e-Taiba, where we show that willingness to fight and die for sacred values shows decreased activity in those areas of the brain concerned with utilitarian reasoning and inhibition of deliberative reasoning in favor of rapid duty-bound responses because they're the right thing to do. And when we take people, say, in the UK or America, we test for their values, like my children or a belief in God, and then we have them say, okay, we'll give you $100. If you sign a piece of paper, which you then tear up, saying, I don't believe in God, we put them under the scanner, and those who really believe they're sacred, they just become absolutely morally outraged at just the very offer. And sometimes, you know, we take students or whatever, I mean, people who really need the money, and they just refuse.
You've hinted already in this conversation about some of the places you've been to. You're a very unusual academic. You're a kind of Indiana Jones. You've been all around the place. Tell me a bit about your methodology and your research.
Well, one of the biggest problems in social science is the gap between studies of expressed willingness to do something and actually doing something. And there are two ways to get around that. First, brain studies, they can help us discover things we didn't know by showing that two things that we thought were unrelated have the same brain signatures. But at a more basic level, they rule out posturing. If you have very different brain responses for sacred versus non-sacred values, that shows you're not pretending, because you can't control those, really. More important, especially if you're trying to do something on the policy level, is when you go to the battlefront and you want to understand willingness to commit, to die, to sacrifice, to fight, you want to go to frontline fighters. On the front line, there's no posturing or pretending either. You either do it or don't. You sacrifice or you don't. If you let down your buddies, they will get rid of you.
So you've got your clipboard and your laptop and you're on the front line watching and recording how people actually behave.
Yes, and we do tests to what degree they're fused, who they're fused with, to what degree they're willing to give up their values or not. But what we find, a very interesting thing which we just found, this is interesting because it shows the value of doing field work and its interaction with theory. Based on evolutionary theory, we felt that those who believe themselves to be strong, committed, will overrate the perceptions of their own body's physical strength and musculature and underrate the others. But then when we were doing the PKK, the Kurdish insurgents in Turkey who had taken refuge in Iraq and were the only ones who held the line against ISIS during its great offensive in June and August 2014, the only ones, save the Yazidis along with the Ipaga, which are their cousins in Syria, and with ISIS fighters, we found that both of them refused to do the experiment. Others did. The American army will do it, the Iraqi army. And we said, why? And he said, because that's not important. It doesn't matter what physical size you have or what weapons you have. It's whether you believe or not. So we went back and we used the same physical stimuli, but this one we said was physical force and this one is spiritual force. And then we had them actually move it on the iPad to get bigger and bigger or smaller and smaller. We had them rate, for example, the Americans and the Brits and the Russians, and we had them rate themselves, ISIS or PKK and the Iraqi army and the Iranians. And it turns out that they rate the Western allies physically maximal, but spiritually middling. ISIS rates themselves and PKK sort of physically very weak, but spiritually very strong. And they believe sincerely that spiritual force trumps physical force. And in fact, that's the case. If you look at insurgency and revolutionary movements since World War II, they on average beat out state and police with up to 10 times more firepower and manpower because state police rely on material rewards and punishments like career advancement and pay, promotion, or punishment.
It's fascinating stuff. The other thing that distinguishes you as an academic is that policymakers are genuinely interested in your work?
Well, they are intrigued, and they do believe that it's true. The question is getting them to respond. So if I go to the White House or I go to the UN Security Council, which I do, and I try to talk to them about these aspects, everyone says, yes, that's it. But almost all refuse to recognize their rivals, adversaries, or enemies as equally motivated by sincere values as they are. And the academic community that plugs into the policy world is mostly political science and economics that take utility and rational choice as the base of how they think. So when you do analyses of why suicide bombers do what they do, for example, you'll find a gazillion articles in the professional journals in economics and politics saying they do it because they're investing in their family, or because their family's going to have higher status, or virgins in heaven, not that virgins in heavens are a material thing, but they believe it's material, or for some other cockamamie reason. You can always find ad hoc rational choice explanations, but it just doesn't get at what they're really doing. Although, you know, if you go to the White House, they'll say, of course that's right. Of course they'll do things because they really believe. But there's no policies there. The military isn't built that way. The political order isn't built that way.
You're an anthropologist, but you could describe yourself as a sociologist, an ethnographer. Is it important to you, that label of anthropologist?
No. Well, anthropology, yes. But anthropology in a way that is not very much in vogue today. You know, I was classically trained as an anthropologist. Well, I was assistant to Margaret Mead. It was a different world. It was education and science. It was not a social critical theory, post-colonial theory. It was just about trying to understand the basic structures of societies and why people do the things they do. That's no longer the case in anthropology. I've resigned from the American Anthropological Association because I thought that the serious science had been not only denigrated, but in fact prevented. The field itself has mutated to something I don't recognize. So I spend much more time working with psychologists and political scientists and playwrights and poets, but trying to bring the science in a human way to the field.
Do you have sacred values?
Yes, I do. Otherwise, I wouldn't go to the places I go to, the sort of dangerous places I go to. I think that ISIS undermines all that I hold sacred. I can't respond to all those things I think are unjust or defy the values that I cherish. But I can go to places and do things where my own experience and expertise might carry some influence and weight. I know the Middle East. I know how the geopolitics work. I speak the languages. I know the cultures. And so I can bring science to the battlefield to help understand and stop the Islamic State.
Scott Atran, thank you very much indeed.
Thanks for talking to me.
Social Science Bites is made in association with Sage. For more interviews, go to socialsciencespace.com.